Okay. All right, we are going to get started. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Mr. Morris, for being here with us and anybody that is joining us online. We are going to start with introductions. We have our new Commissioner Jacob Kapp here with us joining for the first time. Last meeting was technically the first meeting, but you were excused. So if you don't mind doing an introduction for us, we would love to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm Jacob Kapp. I've lived in North Salt Lake now for 10 years.
Can I just remind everybody to talk closer to the mic so it comes over?
Is it working now? There we go. Got to figure this out. But like I said, I'm Jacob Kapp. I've lived in North Salt Lake now for 10 years. I just purchased a lot up in Eaglewood Cove. And Sherry knows I got the better lot up there, right? So I plan on living the rest of my life here in North Salt Lake. My brother and I, we own our own business. We're in the construction industry. We do site development, site utility work. I've been doing that in my entire life out of high school, so a good 35 years now. So I want to give back to the community, so I thought this is the first way to do it. So any other questions anybody has about me, I'm open to book.
Great. Thank you. We're glad to have you here joining us. And as we move forward as kind of a new commission with both of our new members, we're really grateful to have the new insight and the specific angles that you both add to the conversation and discussion as we move forward with the development of North Salt Lake. So thank you for being here and welcome from all of us.
Okay. Thank you.
We will public comment. No public comment. So we will move to agenda item 3. Update presentation for the Town Center IRMA design, and we have Mr. Morris here for that presentation. Thank you for being here.
I just wanted to introduce Mark Morris. He's with VODA, and he's our consultant for the Town Center Urban Design Standards project that some of you are familiar with, but not all of you. And so he's going to kind of catch you all up on basically what this is. You should have all received a link for a survey to do ahead of time, and then he'll be giving a presentation about the results of that survey. And also, I'm Allie Avery, the long-range planner. I think you all know me, but Jacob's first time with me.
There we go. Okay, I will try to speak closely into the microphone. Thanks, Allie, for the introduction. If you may recall, I was here a few months ago now to introduce this project. We're a few months into it and just wanted to have a little bit of a discussion, work session to kind of talk through the urban design standards, what we've been working on, get some input, some feedback from all of you. Several of you have finished the online survey. It'll be open for a while. We have a few other groups that are also providing comment there. So we'll talk about that a little bit, talk about some of the questions that were included in that survey and why we wanted to get your take on those. And overall, just give kind of an update on where we are. We're kind of mid-process on developing these urban design standards. So as a bit of refresher, 10 years ago now, in 2016, the city finished a town center master plan, I think it was called. The master plan really laid the groundwork for what we're doing currently, which is updating the city's code to better reflect some of the vision, some of the things that were included in this town center master plan. So the plan itself included quite a bit of recommendations, analysis. I pulled this page from the Town Center Master Plan just to talk broadly about goals, like what are we doing here with the Town Center? I would say North Salt Lake has a nascent Town Center. There's a City Hall. You're investing in Hatch Park. There's some new development. What we're doing here with these design standards is really saying, okay, for the next 20 years, what are the things that the city should have in place as far as code and zoning go to encourage a more walkable, vibrant town center. So some of the things that were identified during that master plan process, creating a distinct and positive identity. Oh, we're getting some echo, Sherry. Encourage intensity of activity in the town center, improve the appearance and enhance the safety of the town center and the Highway 89 corridor. A lot of these things are in conjunction with investments to roadways and improvements. There are lots of projects that I'm getting a lot of feedback now, Sherry. I feel like I'm going crazy. Okay. The intention is to make sure that these design standards are compatible with and reflect. It's getting worse. And I can speak loudly if I turn off my microphone. Is that okay, Sherry, or does it need to be? Okay. Okay. I feel like the great and powerful Oz. So the intention, again, is not to start from scratch as far as visioning goes, but really to say, okay, here are lots of documents that the city has been working on for the town center, and how do we make sure that the code that is required of new development in this particular area reflects that vision? That's a lot better, Sherry. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So as a bit of introduction to what we've been working through, typical to this type of design standard process is to establish some context. And so this map that you see in front of you, these are four sub-districts that we have worked with city staff to develop to really drill into context for each of these particular parts of the town center. The town center is a pretty large space. It stretches up and down 89 pretty far. Center Street is kind of the crosshairs of the town center. And so each of these colors represent a different sub-district. And so going forward in the design standards, if a property owner or developer shows up, the first question we determine is, okay, which sub-district are we talking about? So these four that you'll get familiar with over time, we have the core center, which is the yellow area, kind of the heart of the town center. We have the boulevard, which are the blue bits on 89 north and south of the core. We've got a neighborhood transition, which is on the east side, kind of along Orchard. And then the green is what we call Park neighborhood. And so going forward, as we're talking about building heights, as we're talking about setbacks, as we're talking about uses, all of that will really be controlled by which sub-district it's in. So just because something is appropriate and encouraged and, you know, we want it to happen in one sub-district doesn't mean it's going to happen in all the sub-districts. So breaking it down into a little bit of smaller scale. So in theory, the idea is that if taller building heights, more intense development would happen in the core and along the boulevard. The neighborhoods on either side, east and west, would be lower intensity, lower heights, to kind of provide a little bit of a buffer to the neighborhoods around it. Any questions initially about the sub-district idea? Seem important? Yeah.
So some of the other communities I'm thinking, like Salt Lake County, that have really done town centers, Mill Creek comes to mind as one example. But
sure.
Have they done the sub-district concept? And if so, are they relatively small like these sub-districts? Because these are small.
Indeed. Yes. So my firm was involved with the master planning behind Mill Creek when they first were sort of at the stage that we're at here. And so breaking it down into kind of smaller sub-districts, that was a key part of that. The Mill Creek Town Center, their city center, is much smaller geographically than what you've got here. And so their sub-districts, I'd say, were a little bit different just because it was a smaller amount of space. But that is a key part, especially when we start to codify design standards, to make sure that we're not painting with too broad of a brush, to say like, okay, if there's a building height, the whole, you know, it could be anywhere. What we want to do is make sure that context is in place. So good question. Any other? Yeah.
I'm sorry. Commissioner Holbrook. Back when we were working on the form-based code, did we have the what's shown here as the Boulevard District being the same as the Boulevard District on the south end of the city? Did we have those the same? Because we had some pretty drastic differences in like building height and things like that between those two. Is it wise to have those the same rather than, I hate to say it, but a fifth district?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I can answer that.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
We did have separate, we had like the North, I don't remember what they were called, North 89 and Boulevard, I think, maybe. And they do have different heights, but Mark is able to simplify it to write into the Boulevard District different height restrictions based off of where you are in the Boulevard District, which he'll probably get to later in this presentation.
Indeed.
Gotcha. Understood. Thanks.
Yeah, so we actually, we started with...
I have one question, if I may.
Yeah, of course.
This is Commissioner Kapp. So the Boulevard District on the south end, does that take into account the future interchange that's going to be going in down there with the possible different type of businesses going to be near
sure.
the freeway interchange?
Yeah, so this code really deals with what are the properties that you've got today. So we've talked about kind of future changes. You know, you've got the BRT coming through, you've got an interchange change. So this code would really apply it to existing conditions. Looking forward to kind of say, oh, there will be some changes. Eventually, when those things start to happen, there may be some modification here. So even these design standards, these are not set in stone for all time. The expectation is that as things change, there may be an adjustment to what the code is. So the sub-districts, again, the intention here is to inject context into the standards where we make sure that we're applying appropriate standards in across the town center. So like Ali alluded to, we are trying to make this as concise and as simple as possible. There is always going to be complexity. But what we're trying to do is to keep this a pretty short document. You could have design standards that are hundreds of pages long. There are cities that do that, and you know, Park City comes to mind. If you're a developer, Park City is sort of like everyone's nightmare because they've got so many requirements for the reasons that Park City knows. With this document, we're trying to keep it to really focus on the elements of urban design that are really difficult to change once something has been built. And so these sections, we'll go through these and kind of talk through each of these. You may recognize some of the questions from that survey were specific to some of these elements. And when I say the difficult to change parts of urban design, where a building is situated on a lot, that is very difficult to change. What color of paint that building has or what material it has on the exterior, those are relatively easy things to change. You can't pick up a building and pull it 40 feet towards the street very easily. And so with something like these design standards, what we're trying to focus the conversation on, focus the energy on, is really worrying about the things that once in place are kind of there for a long time. So we'll talk a bit about setbacks. We'll talk about building heights, facade articulation we'll get into a little bit, ground floor activation, and other requirements. So those are categories that we want to make sure we're focusing the design standards on. The method that we'll kind of go through these, as part of the scope of this project, we've developed what we call a prototype. And the prototype is intended to just show how these particular standards would be applied to a specific real world parcel in the town center. We have some communication with the owner of this property, so we're not applying this as if to say we're designing something that will get built. It's really just to say, okay, if and when the post office is no longer there, these parcels get developed, as a city, what sort of questions would we ask when a developer property owner walks in the door. So we've done these similarly in other communities, and the intention with the prototype is that this gets used as a tool by planning staff, by the planning commission, by the city council. So when planning staff comes to you with a memo that says, okay, here's a proposal, here's a development, they would use portions of the prototype to kind of talk through what are the elements that are under discussion. So as you can see, the little blue circle there, this is the corner where the post office sits and a few parcels to the south. I forget the name of the car lot that's on the parcel, but what we're really doing is kind of showing, okay, on a corner, how would these design standards be applied? As I mentioned, the location of the building on the lot, the setbacks, that's kind of question number one. How do we make sure that we're pulling the building up to the street and that what's going on the ground floor of that building is adding to what, you know, vibrancy at the pedestrian level? So in the prototype, and again, with each sub-district, you would have different requirements, but where the building is located, what sort of footprint sits on that corner, those are all initial initial questions that would be asked as part of these design standards. So we're bringing the building to the street. We're requiring primary entrances on the street-facing side of the buildings, and pushing parking and other things to the backside of the parcel. I've dropped in just a draft table, just as a bit of introduction. We won't overwhelm you with tables tonight. Just wanted you to see, when the code is put together and finalized, what we would have is a series of tables that would be related to each of these parameters. So each of these colors represent one of those four sub-districts. And so the intention is that it's very easy. Okay, if I am a property owner, I know I'm in the Boulevard sub-district, making sure I know, okay, here's the requirement for what this, you know, this particular table. So you don't need to know every single field in the table, but it makes it easy to say, okay, I'm going to stick to this blue column. That's where the parameters I need are going to be found. So setbacks, again, very important element here. Building heights, you know, we pulled the building to the street. In this particular example, we're on a corner. Heights of buildings, as you know, as planning commissioners, building height is something where a lot of the pushback and a lot of the struggle is. So one of the reasons to have the sub-districts broken down is to ensure that building heights that might be appropriate along 89 or in the core, we're not applying those elsewhere. And so each of these sub-districts, you would have a different maximum height. So you can see the image on the top, we've got some maximum ground floor, maximum height that are separated by a difference between the ground floor and the upper floors. Those are regulated differently. And the way that those heights are articulated, like Ali mentioned, like we can control those differently around the town center. So one of the questions from that survey, we were talking a little bit about maximum height in the heart of the town center. We'll get to that discussion later. But again, the prototype kind of walks through each of those elements. Another important piece, if there are questions as we go, by all means.
Yeah, Commissioner Marsh. The thing that's most interesting to me is not the maximum, but the minimum. So for example, sure, when you switch between minimum heights, you go potentially between IRC versus IBC. Is there a reason why, if you're going to go 4, you wouldn't say 5? Like, what is the reasoning behind calling out like 4 as a minimum?
Sure, that is a great question. So as with most parts of these design standards, there's going to be a range where we can say, okay, we've got a minimum and we've got a maximum. The reason why we like to put a minimum height is to ensure that we're not, you know, if we're tearing down a one-story building and building a one-story building, we're not really getting enough critical mass to kind of create a vibrant center. And so each of these sub-districts, we would say, okay, our minimum is 3, our maximum is 6, or our minimum is 2. What we're trying to do is increase the intensity of use in the town center in order to get to that that level of vibrancy. The, you know, all of these, of course, you would, building codes would be applied to, which building codes, you know, depending on heights and so forth. The important thing there, again, is to increase the intensity in the town center.
Right. And I guess for the specific example, it's just, if you're going to go 4, why wouldn't you set it to 5? Sort of. But I get that that's maybe too specific of a question, but.
No, I think that's a good question. I think I am probably I would accept higher building heights than perhaps the general public in the community might.
Sure.
As you know, like, if you're in a community where most of the buildings are 1 or 2 stories, a 5-story building is going to seem just wildly out of scale. The first few projects that happen in the town center, that scale may seem really off, but the intention is that over time you would have more of that and it would feel again like this is the center of activity. So also with these, you know, just because we set a maximum height at 5 or 6 stories, that isn't to say like everyone is going to come along and try to max out the cost of construction. You know, the taller you go, the more expensive every square foot is, and so every property developer is going to have a different kind of approach to how much they're willing to risk as part of the development. So
thanks.
All of these parameters, like, these are very much just in draft form. We've worked with planning staff to kind of calibrate them in a way that seems appropriate. If we get to the point where it's like, well, if we're going 4, why don't we go 5? But again, that's where all your pushback is going to be in the end, is those building heights.
And I guess if you start from a higher minimum, then you can negotiate down. It's harder to negotiate up. So that's
indeed.
That's why I'm bringing it up now. When in this context, so
that is a good approach. We did some work last year in Murray, and we're doing some design standards for their city center, and we started pretty high. And by the time we got to the end of the project, we found that Planning Commission, City Council, like, they saw the wisdom in why those heights, you know, we needed to have a pretty high maximum. And they ended up supporting, like, some I'd say, relatively tall maximum heights. Another factor with building heights is that if we set the ceiling too low, we're really limiting how much of that site is going to be used by active uses. If we set the height too low, we're kind of consigned to using a lot of the square footage for surface parking, which is also not going to bring a lot of vibrancy to the town center. So, but we, again, once we get into kind of more discussions around heights, we can figure out if we're in the right range for those. The next one I wanted to talk about was facade articulation. These standards are not architectural guidelines. So we are not saying, here is a style that the architecture has to follow. Here are specific materials that have to be used everywhere. What we're really saying is, we want to make sure that the form of the development is doing the things that are going to make a vibrant town center, but are not so prescriptive that an architectural team is going to feel like they're being told everything that they have to do. Again, going back to the Park City example, you go to Park City and there's like, okay, here's the stone you're going to use, here's the wood you're going to use. They have a very specific set of design standards, which is not what we're doing here. I dropped in a couple images of just when we start talking about architectural articulation. There's image on the left, you can see the architecture in this image, like, it is in the end quite simple, but the articulation is such that you look at this building and there is a sense of high quality, it has interest, there's lots going on, it feels like, again, a nicely designed building. Building on the right is a different context, obviously, but just as an example of low articulation. Like, this is a different architectural style, but also they're very, very little articulation in that example. Lots of blank walls, infrequent doors and windows. What we're trying to encourage is the high amount of articulation that we see on the left side there. Articulation of architecture, again, those are things that we're going to care about. The prototype, as you can see, it has measurements that say, okay, every 30 feet, we have to have some level of articulation in that structure. What we're trying to avoid is a building that's 200 feet long and is just kind of a blank surface. So requiring that articulation, again, is not establishing a specific architectural style, but really saying, how do we make sure that we're breaking up the masses of these structures? Also in the design standards, there is a fair amount of attention paid to pedestrian area improvements. So we're really saying, what's going on between the curb of the street and the facade of the building? And again, with each of these sub-districts, we would have different requirements. So in some of these sub-districts in the core and in the places where we would have a much more urban style of development, the requirements would be different than the park, the park neighborhood that feels far more single family and a little bit more residential in scale. So there's a fair amount of requirement in the standards, or will be, as far as what's going on, frequency of street trees, the type of furnishings, all of those things are included in the design standards. Any questions about any of that? Hope keeping up so far. Okay. With the prototype, one of the things that we like to do is just give an example of, okay, here are some buildings that kind of follow that form. They're intentionally kind of architecturally not super interesting, just so we don't get distracted by that and we kind of focus on the form of the building itself. So these examples that you see, let's go back one more. You can see that the kind of massing of the buildings, the types of roofs, the amount of permeability, those are the things that the design standards really focus on. We still want to give property owners, developers, architectural teams lots of leeway as far as if they like modern, they want something historic, they are free to do that, so long as we have the kind of forms that we're hoping for. Also in the design standards, there's discussion of transparency. So the frequency of windows, how much blank surface you see on public-facing streets, blank wall limitation, those are all things that the design standards will regulate. And again, different for different sub-districts. So focus again on how much of a articulated, interesting building you have versus getting into specific architectural style. The final bit that we'll talk about as far as the prototype goes is use. With most cities, we live in a land use table. Like, it's always about permitted uses. There's a lot of control that is focused there. With design standards like these, the intention is to give a lot more generous approach to uses, to say, okay, property owner shows up, they have a use in mind, something that's feasible, something that will pencil. They are given a long list of options as far as those uses go. The way that the design standards separate that is to have different allowable uses for ground floor and different allowable uses for upper floor. So this image you see in the bottom left shows ground floor versus upper floor differentiation. The reason why we do that is to, again, talk about how do we activate the ground floor of the town center. If you're a pedestrian, if you're a human experiencing the town center, how active that ground floor space is going to determine how engaging and how interesting that that space is. So the image on the left, we can see a high amount of activation. So we have public-facing ground floor uses. So those uses are things that are a little bit more approachable to the general public. They may not all necessarily be retail spaces that you can walk in and shop, but at least something that is public-facing. So not private residential in kind of key parts. Market study that I think was it last year or 24 that was completed in the last 18 months, there was a lot of discussion in that document about retail, that we can't require retail everywhere we want retail to work. It just doesn't work that way. And so in a design standard document like this, what we want to focus on is say, okay, here's a list of uses for ground floors in, you know, particular sub-districts. How do we get as many things on those ground floors that are a lot more public facing? That activation, again, it's an outgrowth of use, but also the actual design of those ground floors. So you can see this image on the left. We've got lots of doors and windows. There's spaces that are interesting. You look at that and you say, oh, I want to go to there. The image on the left you can see is the polar opposite of that, where we have blank walls, we have no active entries, like whatever use is happening on the ground floor, these are very private uses. And you can see from this actual photograph that this isn't a place where pedestrians are. I think this is Houston, which is kind of its own thing. So use, again, with standards like these, we want to make sure that you feel comfortable with kind of releasing the grip on use a little bit, where we're regulating kind of what we want to get out of it in a different way and allowing a lot more leeway to property owners to say, this is a project where I think I can make office pencil or residential retail. All of those things are given a little bit more of a free hand. There would still be a list of uses that would not be allowed under any circumstances. So we're not just, you know, opening the barn doors, but we're really saying giving property owners a little bit more generous approach to use in exchange for more requirements for the actual form of the project. Questions about that? Feeling good so far?
Okay. Now we kind of talked in depth on that when we had the last briefing meeting over on the side. So I think several of us have heard that before, and I think we understand.
Okay, that's great. That's great. And I very much understand, like, you know, use is something that we've always had a lot of, you know, that we're kind of focused so much on use. But with these types of standards, just making that a little bit easier. If you're a property owner in the town center, you may see, oh, the city's coming and they're just putting all these, you know, more requirements on me. There's some push and pull here where we're saying, okay, we're going to give you a little bit more leeway on some things in exchange for more requirements in other ways. Okay, and then in the prototype again, just some kind of illustrative imagery to show, okay, we're talking about specific things when it comes to pedestrian spaces. How articulated is the building? How transparent is the building? Again, these are intentionally schematic buildings so that you can kind of see, as far as design standards like these go, what are the things that we're focused on? And these, again, will be part of the kind of final document, and you may see these from time to time from planning staff in memos as they go. And then finally, other requirements that are included in design standards like these: landscape, parking, lighting, signage. These are all things that are typical for urban design standards. I'd say most of the battles that you will have will be around building heights and parking. You probably have already heard that before. The other pieces are important to include, but are usually not high conflict points for design standards like these. So again, we're trying to keep this a pretty simple, concise set of design standards, just making sure that we're covering all of our bases. Any questions about any of that? Okay. When we come back and talk a little bit more about parking, we'll talk more about methods to help encourage shared parking and other parking management systems for town center type spaces. Changing parking requirements and reducing parking requirements in town centers is really important so that we don't spend all of our energy and all of our money on overparking a town center when we really need to be building more housing and destinations and things that are really going to make a more vibrant vibrant place. Okay. Any questions so far? We're doing okay. How are we doing on time, Allie? Well, I don't want to be here all night, but okay. So if you haven't already completed the let's go to full screen mode. If you haven't already completed the survey, you are more than welcome to keep doing that, or visit it if you have not. If you would like to revisit the survey or change your answers, you are more than welcome to do that after our discussion tonight. It's not going to, if you log in on the same computer, it's not going to tell you you can't take the survey again. So this survey, we wanted to gauge interest and support for different ideas and concepts and talk about it a little bit as a group. We'll also, when we go to the city council, we'll talk over some of these things as well. So I have the survey. Let me skip back over to this. So the survey itself, we can go through these and kind of talk about the responses that that you provided. The other groups that this was given to was the
Arts Committee the Trails Committee.
And the Trails Committee, okay. So we wanted elected and appointed groups to provide some input. We'll also give it to the City Council, yes, when the time comes. Just again to kind of focus on some of these really key pieces of these design standards. So, first question: which elements of urban design would you rank as most important to you to implement? So this was one. If you remember, you could kind of drag things in order. The one that received the highest ranking. The blue here, engaging ground floor uses and pedestrian-oriented spaces, which I think that's the whole ball game when it comes to a town center. We need to have activated ground floor spaces. We've all visited places where there's just an seemingly endless amount of things to see and do. These destinations may be things that are more kind of appointment-based, like you're going to dinner or lunch, or other things that are a little bit more day-to-day, you know, destinations. Is it where your accountant is? Is it where you get your hair cut? All of those things happening in the town center, again, can create a more active space. The second there, density of uses and activities, that really goes hand-in-hand with that ground floor activation. In town center type spaces, what's going on upstairs in these buildings is far less important than what's going on the ground floor. So right now we're in a housing crisis. You're probably seeing a lot of housing proposals. You're definitely going to see some proposals for additional housing in the town center, office, hospitality, hotels, all of those things happening upstairs. Again, those are important. Those bring a lot of activity. But for the community or people visiting, you want to make sure that ground floor is active. So you can see here the way that the survey software works is that it gives a score based on, you know, how these were all ranked. You can see 10 respondents put that engaging ground floor space as their first pick. Which I think is great, and again, that's the whole ballgame, so we got to make sure that we're focusing our attention on that ground floor active use. So far we've had 12 respondents. Hopefully we'll get a few more. Question two, which types of public gathering spaces do you think would be the most impactful for the town center? So these are all pretty even. You can see the central civic gathering space kind of squeaked out a little bit of a first place ranking there. the question here isn't so much to put these in order, but to kind of say, you know, we can do all of these things, but which do we prioritize? I think you're already doing a lot of investment with Hatch Park. There are other opportunities as well in the town center to kind of focus on what are the gathering spaces. In town centers like this, there will be privately owned and managed outdoor plaza spaces, you know, dining patios and things like that. But that investment in kind of a central gathering space is a key piece of this. So with Mill Creek, for example, how many of you have been to Mill Creek recently? Okay, Mill Creek of 5 years ago is a wildly different place than it is today. There's a lot going on in their city center. The very first thing they did was, okay, we're going to design and build a huge gathering space. So the big ice ribbon and it's roller skating in the summer, that was a very specific catalyst project that the city said, okay, even before anything gets built, we want to establish that this is a place where people gather. And so I think with how far Hatch Park is down the road, I think you're in a great spot. I think with these design standards, we want to make sure that the energy around Hatch Park and other spaces is contributing to that. Okay, the building heights question. Which maximum building heights would you support at the heart of the town center to create enough concentration to support a vibrant center? This is an interesting experiment. So you can see the first priority or the first ranked here was 4 to 5 stories. Had a fair number that said 6+ stories. So it sounds like there's a little bit more tolerance for some taller development. Of the 12 respondents, no one said 3 to 4 stories. So we're already in a place where, okay, we're okay with a little bit taller development here in the center. That's not to say in the neighborhoods to the east or west that we would say, okay, 3 or 4 story max may be appropriate, but in the core, we want to make sure that we're going high enough. I think if we end up with 4 or 5 story maximum, that's going to give us enough space for the feasibility of development to do structured parking. Inevitably, a developer is going to want to structure that parking. At the end of the day, that project has to pay for that structured parking. And so when we go higher, it becomes a lot more financially feasible to do that. So any questions or specific thoughts about building heights? I know that's a big topic.
So yeah. Just based on your experience, is there any benefit in terms of affordable housing when town centers get developed? Does your experience suggest that translate into helping with our moderate income housing plan and all that, or not?
Sure.
It does.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So there's sort of capital A affordable housing, and then there's affordable housing. You know, we all live in housing that at the end of the day we can afford. If it's something that you're allowing higher buildings to be built, you're going to have developers come along who want to go through the process of getting tax credits and all of the things to have kind of income-restricted housing. I think you'll see a lot of different types. I think you'll see housing that they'll come in and they'll spin as luxury housing and all of that. You'll also see proposals that would be far more affordable housing projects, which I think there is a place for all of that in the town center. But I think making sure that we're not putting a roof that's too low on the town center so that those become less financially feasible. If you go to Mill Creek, there are city center, there may be 5 or 6 like under construction housing projects today. I don't know if any of them have opened yet, but a lot of those, again, were sort of kickstarted through the kind of master planning of how do we make sure that we're allowing heights for these to pencil. So there's quite a bit going on there.
Did Mill Creek use any RDA funding for their, were you aware if they used RDA for any of that?
I don't know if they used RDA funding. One of the very first things the city did was to start buying up land. So they were very adamant that they wanted to have a lot more control in the situation. And so they went in and started buying parcels really, I'd say, semi-aggressively. I think where they wanted to introduce a huge amount of public space, like the city had to own, you know, they had to own that land to start with. I can find out. I don't know if they went through the process to make that an RDA area or a CRA area. But they certainly used city money for sure.
Just off the top of your head, do you know what the building height is of that main building at Mill Creek Commons where they have like the farmer's market in the bottom?
The city hall.
Yeah.
I want to say it's six stories.
Around six.
I think it's six, yeah. Which when they built that, I mean, it felt very tall. And now that there are some other things... Yeah, yeah. And that also kind of brings up, you know, when they built that city hall, there's a housing building that's under construction right now next door. There's actually a parking structure between the two that was kind of a legal agreement between the city and the developer to say, okay, we both need parking. It's expensive to pay for. How do we come up with an arrangement to get the most out of that structure? But I'm pretty sure it's six stories. So I wouldn't be nervous about, you know, allowing some height. At the end of the day, the thing that is going to determine whether those heights are feasible is economics. So just because, you know, it's feasible in Mill Creek City Center, a developer may come along and say, you know, the highest we really need to go is five, and there's nothing wrong with that. What I would say is we just want to make sure that we're allowing things high enough that if someone comes along and says, oh, I want to do six or seven stories, that it's at least allowed from the city's standpoint. Construction methods change pretty drastically once you get past that amount. So just because we're saying we're allowing, you know, six or seven stories, the odds of someone coming in and saying, I want to build a 20-story building are pretty close to zero. So I think it's really saying, okay, what the maximum for this method of construction, how high is the city going to allow? More on building heights. Any other?
Commissioner Marsh, I guess there was a proposal at one point to do 10 at City Center. Sherry? Or was it 8? What was the max on that one RDA proposal?
Was this one here? It started at six. Sorry. I'm used to talking really close and loud.
I thought it was taller than that, but I guess I was mistaken.
No, it was six.
What was the one over there?
The tallest one on Williamsburg is six as well. And I just looked up Mill Creek and it is six.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the sweet spot economically and kind of vibrancy-wise, that five or six story range, like that's a really good, you know, good height to aim for. I think it's feasible from a construction standpoint. Your town center is a little tricky because you have a lot of lots that are pretty shallow. They're kind of long and shallow, and so there may be a little, assembling of parcels that needs to happen. But aiming for five or six stories, I think that's a great. That's not to say let's allow seven. In these types of design standards, we may say, okay, five is, you know, what we want to allow. If you want to go to seven, you have to step back, you know, 30 feet or something, so that height is kind of minimized a little bit and from, you know, kind of a pedestrian standpoint. I think in Sugar House, the tallest buildings in Sugar House, I think, are probably seven. So there may be some office there that's a little bit taller, but even in a place like Sugar House, you know, we're not getting 20-story buildings yet. They've had a couple proposals that have never come to fruition, but even in a place like that, economically, like seven is kind of the max that we see. Okay, great. Question four, which approach to a transition requirement between the core of the town center core and adjacent residential areas would you rank most important? So buffering between this intensity of development and the neighborhoods around it is a really key part of developing standards like these. So you can see each of these, I would say, pretty evenly prioritized from this group and others. Each of these, I would say, have a place. It's really dependent on the parcel and the type of development. But these types of buffers, whether it's stepping down, Ali alluded to some of those, you know, the north end of the boulevard and the south end of the boulevard, those types of step backs and things that would be required would be a little bit different based on the neighborhood around it. The north end of the boulevard, there's a lot more single family really adjacent to these parcels. And so how those heights are minimized, saying, okay, you can build a six-story building if, you know, right up against 89, but the closer you get to those single-family neighborhoods, the lower those heights that would be allowed. So these buffering conversations, those are important, and again, are kind of baked into the cake with these types of design standards.
Commissioner Jorgensen, can I ask a question? So specifically to the core where it's on the other side of Highway 89 along Orchard Drive, on the opposite side of it, it's outside the town center on the west side of Orchard. This is going down towards Eagle Ridge, just down the south end, for example. Anyway, there's single family residence and then there'd be core. And as you think about the transition and so forth, how would that apply? And the reason I ask that is because this was the sixth story on 130 East. And that neighborhood was absolutely, they had two major concerns, and one of them was building height. Sure. The other one was something else. But anyway, would you just comment about, would the buffers be applied to help mitigate those type of concerns, or can you just comment on that?
Yeah, I think that particular area has been a significant part of our conversation around how to deal with these types of buffers. And so allowing, you know, say the core, we said, okay, we're allowing five-story maximum in the core, or six-story maximum. If that is touching up against a single-family neighborhood like it would on the south end of Orchard, we would say, okay, your maximum height up against Orchard would be, we'll say, three stories. The taller parts of your project would have to be further west to mitigate exactly that type of concern. That whole sub-district on that east side of the core, the intention there is to say, okay, let's have lower allowable heights in that neighborhood transition area, just so we're mitigating against that concern that, you know, a six-story building is going to be across the street from a single-family home. So the Salt Lake City went through a similar process when Sugar House really started to develop about 10 or 15 years ago. And you can see a difference in the type of development that is built now versus what was built then, because they hadn't kind of considered these things. And you can see there are single family homes and there's a seven-story building right next door. So those were really built prior to this type of standard being applied. So we're trying to inject some concentration and some density, but do it in a way that recognizes that these are still neighborhoods that have concerns, and very valid concerns.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We do need a Bruges waffle house, though, as long as you're writing the plan.
Yeah, get some good waffles up here. Those types of buffers, those are kind of core to the conversation around, okay, we know we want some intensity, but we also know we have to buffer that in specific ways. The next question, which streetscape elements, in your opinion, would have the largest impact? You can see these are pretty closely ranked. We can see the pedestrian scale lighting and benches kind of eked out a little bit of a first ranking there. Each of these, again, would be part of the design standards. It's really just thinking about, okay, which are the higher priorities that we want to focus on. Okay, building materials. Which primary materials best reflect your vision for the town center character? So materials, at the end of the day, do have a major impact on the look and feel of a place. Generally, with standards like these, we're going to say, here's a list of high-quality materials that must be your primary building material, but we're not going to say, here's the color of brick or the color of stone that you have to use. You can see here in the middle, brick or stone, but in a more contemporary way, that seemed to be the highest ranked. Some materials feel more intentional and more long-lasting than others. And so looking at design standards that allow for some flexibility of choice, but also recognize we don't want a stucco box town center. That's not what anyone is after. Material requirements for standards like these also would differentiate between the primary facade and secondary and tertiary facades of a building. And so if less I guess, less expensive material is used on secondary facades. That would be perfectly allowable. Historically, that's how buildings have always been built, that you use your nicest, most expensive material on the front face. But just ensuring that we're using high quality materials to add to, again, the feeling of endurance and quality in the town center. Parking, everyone's favorite topic. Which parking management methods would you support to promote a more walkable town center? These honestly are pretty closely ranked. You can see that the reduced parking requirements near BRT stations was ranked a little bit higher than the others. At the end of the day, for a town center, and I know you've already got shared parking options and things on the books, but making sure that we're not trying to overpark the town center in such a way that all of the energy and effort and cost is being sunk into parking as opposed to the other things that are going to bring vibrancy. I think the BRT project, as it comes through, that'll add a lot of foot traffic and so forth. Transit and high transit or high frequency transit like the BRT really is an extension of walkability. And so we know that if people are getting off the BRT or getting on the BRT, that's kind of an epicenter of the odds of someone arriving on foot are a lot higher. So each of these methods, I think, are valid and worth considering. Having the on-street parking signed and time-limited, I think, is really key as more development happens in the town center to make sure that if someone's coming to work 8 hours on a shift at a restaurant, they're not leaving their car in that high value space right in front of the restaurant for their entire shift. And so putting something in that would at least limit the amount of time that someone can use that on-street parking. The last thing you want is the perception that, oh, if I go to the town center, I'm never going to find a place to park or it's going to be a hassle. It may be a little different than parking at Costco, but you want to make sure that if you're just going into the town center for something quick, on-street parking is something that's readily available. If you're going to be there for several hours, there's adequate parking in a structure or behind behind buildings.
Hey, Mark.
So, yeah.
Over here. I just wanted to mention one thing about, I remember when I first started in planning and I didn't know what all the acronyms meant. So BRT, I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with BRT, stands for Bus Rapid Transit that we'll be having on Highway 89. And so it's a nicer bus that has more distance between the stops, but more frequency in how many buses are coming. So it comes more frequently and has less stops, so it's a faster bus. And we'll be getting that, on, like I said, on Highway 89. So that's what he's talking about when he says BRT.
Thank you for reminding me of the jargon that I blow past. BRT generally, it's like tracks on wheels. It's like the distance between stations is similar to the tracks system. And that frequency, like Allie mentioned, that it's something that's coming through every, every 10 or 15 minutes. Remind me, there is a planned station on the north end near 350 North. Is that correct?
I think we have one here near City Hall. We have one on the south by in front of Eaglewood Village. And then I don't think the next one is until you get up to Camelot.
A little bit further.
They had previously said they would put one at 350 North, but I think that's been taken off the books.
Okay. So parking requirements, again, in the final design standards, they would be regulated by sub-district. So just because it's required in one, it isn't required in all. But I think just thinking about a reduction in parking requirements for the town center, that's something that's important for these types of standards. And that is the last of the survey. Any questions or thoughts on any of the survey questions? Did they seem related to what we're talking about? Like I said, you are more than welcome to revisit that survey if you've got other thoughts or questions, even if you just want to write a comment in the comment box. the intention, again, is just to kind of talk about what are the really key tentpole pieces of the design standards that we need to discuss and make sure that you feel comfortable with. At the end of the day, you'll hopefully be recommending these design standards for adoption by the City Council, and so just want to make sure that you feel like you understand why we're focusing on these particular elements. And I think that is the end.
Did you have any of these comments, the additional thoughts or ideas, or any of the other things that were filled in?
You know, there were only four. That was the most skipped question. There were only four, and I can send you what the comments were, but they were pretty brief. There was nothing in there that was, I'd say, a red flag or anything.
I could add a fifth if you want.
Sure.
How feasible is it to tie in as a requirement for utilities, of burying utilities?
Because
along that route has power poles that are unsightly, and how feasible is it to have that as a requirement?
That's a good question. I don't know that I've ever worked on urban design standards that had that as a specific requirement, but I think we could certainly put that in there. I think utilities and those requirements are generally in the public works.
I think you'd hate to have that brand new building with this nice facade and a power pole.
Power lines right in front of it, yeah.
We can definitely include it. We've had it in our P District requirements along Highway 89. We have the power poles along the west side of Highway 89 here that need to be buried, and we have used some RDA funds to bury the utilities in exchange for affordable housing units, deed-restricted affordable housing units, things like that. So we can definitely include that as something.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. But we'll have an answer for you next time. Yeah,
any other comments from
questions?
I really appreciate the usability of this document and the multiple levels of understanding it with the imaging and the proposed areas and just the idea of what could happen there. I really appreciate that as both a citizen and on the Planning Commission, just anybody that interfaces with the way that it's structured feels like it has a very usable feel and it's not overwhelming or overcomplicated in a way that just buries both the Planning Commission and the staff and applicants. So bravo to everybody that worked on that to make it feel so accessible.
Yeah, one of the elements that we're developing as part of these standards is a worksheet. A lot of the cities that we've worked with on these types of standards, we basically develop, it's a really, almost a checklist. And it makes it a lot easier for staff, for Planning Commission, for property owners to say, okay, here are the parameters that we care about. Please fill this out and show us where you meet them. That helps to narrow the conversation if they say, okay, there's this one parameter, we want more height, or we want something specific. You can say, okay, everything on the list is checked off. We've got these two things that we're really, really focused on. And the feedback we've gotten is that property owners appreciate that there's no surprises. They know exactly what they're being asked. Planning staff knows where to kind of focus the attention. But also if, you know, planning staff comes to you as the Planning Commission, you can say, okay, here's what they're proposing, here's what they've filled out, they've got one ask, and we need to consider it, we need to talk about if they say planning staff recommends or does not recommend. It's again, we're really trying to focus on usability, because for time immemorial, like, cities have just been this black box of like, oh, you never know when they're going to come to you and say, surprise, we want you to do this. And so we try to make it as user-friendly as possible with lots of graphics and diagrams, but also the process is clearly spelled out, that it's, again, trying to get rid of the unknowns and the surprises that no one on either side appreciates or enjoys.
Sorry, I have one question. This is Commissioner Stone.
Sure.
Maybe you talked about this, I missed it, but I know we talked about it before about bike lanes and stuff. Like, what is the bikeability, like, the vision of that?
Sure. So these design standards are really applied from back of curb to the building. And so we actually have been working with the group that's working on the South Davis Greenway project and other documents that are kind of on the books for the city already that kind of say, okay, here's your corridor, here's the what's proposed for curb to building. So bikeability and all of those things, you know, the multi-use pathways on 89 and Orchard and so forth, we're really trying to make sure that these are compatible and working together, but recognizing that those are kind of separate efforts.
So. We also just recently in recent meetings with Mark have decided that we need to have like street types, which were in the form-based code draft. So, but the street types are going to be treated a little differently in that we won't be reviewing what happens in front of the curb, only what happens in the pedestrian space behind the curb. And so there will be like a center street type and a Highway 89 type, and that will determine what type of a path we're going to have, like a side path on Highway 89 where bikes can go, because obviously you don't want the bikes on in the travel lanes of Highway 89. So that will talk about the pedestrian and cyclist treatment that happens, and it will be in these design standards. And then separately, like Mark was mentioning, we have the South Davis Greenway, which will be, it's looking like it will be aligned up on Orchard Drive and connecting down at the Eagle Ridge roundabout and connecting to that frontage road trail. And so that South Davis Greenway will come from all the way up from Farmington down through into Salt Lake City. And so that will be on the perimeter of the town center, and that will determine that treatment there. But those pedestrian treatments will be in these design standards, just nothing in the travel lanes. So no bike lanes or anything like that will be determined by this study.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. You know, bikeability, walkability kind of go hand in hand. And so recognizing that you've got other efforts and other projects, we want to make sure, again, we're focused on curb to building, making sure, okay, what's the width of these multi-use paths? If it's out in, you know, if it's a bike lane out in the street, that's kind of a separate thing. But just making sure that we're not requiring something here that's in conflict with these other, you know, other projects.
And we've discussed how it's not vague, but not specific. Is it the philosophy of the city that as developments come along in the Boulevard and the core district that it would be our intention to encourage a P district so that we do have specificity when the time comes?
This would replace the P district process in the town center. So instead of having to negotiate and determine individually what's going to happen on each site, we're just saying these are the expectations for the town center. But the P district still could be used outside of the town center. We're not getting rid of that tool. Just the town center will have the expectations clearly laid out.
And so the reason I ask is that development that we had on Orchard, that they kind of just built it the way they wanted because it fit inside the code, but it didn't really match the aesthetic of the flow of that street. Are we going to have that again?
We are not going to have that again because we're going to adopt these design standards that give us the tools to not get that.
Even though they're vague.
Yeah. So, no, because they are vague sort of, but they still are saying like you have to be set back this much, you have to have this much glazing, you have to have these types of materials, you know, you have choices. So it gives them a menu of choices that they can use when they're designing it, as opposed to that development was just zoned RM20 that says, hey, the front setback's 20 feet, the maximum height is 35 feet, and that's it. And 20 units per acre. So that zoning had absolutely no design guidelines in it that says how far buildings should be back, how they step against other buildings, those types of things.
No.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, and I think the hope is not that these would be vague, but they would give property owners some leeway. So each of these parameters would have a range that they could fall within, but as long as they fall within that range, it's okay. But again, there's quite a bit in here that, you know, there would be a lot of requirements, but the intention is to be as straightforward as, you know, get what the city needs, but also give the, you know, a design team the options that they may want.
Great, thank
so,
you.
So can I ask one more question? Yeah. Commissioner Jorgensen. So Mark, thank you. This question is actually more for Allie and Sherry. So what do you foresee as the path forward, you know, to completion, the process and the steps, the timeline? And I guess in particular, are there any prerequisites from all these other moving pieces like the Greenway and the Town Center Master Plan that have to be finalized before this can be finalized? But anyway, can you give us a rough idea?
So, Mark, what was our end date? Is it June for this project?
Yeah, I don't know that I can't recall the end date. Maybe to answer your question, we're in kind of draft mode where we're working on like a full draft of all of the design standards. That's not to say it's not going to take us a few months to kind of get through review and feedback and revisions, but I would say we're kind of 50% of the way through the project, if not a little bit more. So the next time you see me, we'll most likely have a draft that will say, okay, here's the draft, here's what it says, give you an opportunity to provide feedback and intention. I would imagine that would probably be in 2 months.
Yeah, I think that what's really nice about the timing of this project, in coordination with the timing of these other projects you mentioned, is that they're all kind of going at the same time. They're all going to be ending at the same time. So like the Greenway, for example, we're already at the point where we have a really good idea of what that cross-section is going to look like, so we can incorporate that here. And then we just barely have finalized the US 89 corridor agreement with UDOT, which also specifies those same things on Highway 89. And then we have Hatch Park developing right now, you know, we have those plans finalized. And so we have all these projects that are all kind of coming together at the same time to inform this this zoning. And so I think what will happen is it will come through you guys. It's not gonna be like the form-based code where it drags on for a year and a half plus. We will have it adopted this summer. And so everything should be in place for us to be able to be implementing this zoning ordinance by, I would say, end of summer.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for all the work on it. It looks great.
Yeah, thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
All right, and then we will excuse Commissioner Marsh for the remainder of the meeting. He had another commitment, and then we will move to agenda item 4, review 2026 calendar. Any comments on the calendar? Do we need to approve it? It's been approved by City Council, right? Oh, okay, sorry. Rarely do I move faster than the technology, so.
The technology's working flawlessly tonight for us. Sorry.
There it is. All right, Sherry, do we need to approve this, or this is just for our information?
So the City Council acted to approve it.
Great.
But if you have anything that we need to adjust, we can always take that back to the City Council. Okay. We just didn't remember to bring it to you before the City Council had it on their calendar. So
we're not mad at that. Any comments about the meeting dates from the Commission?
And that June date is the only one we moved to a Wednesday for a primary
Okay.
election.
Thank you. And then agenda item 5, report on city council action items.
Okay, so just some updates from last week's council items. So we have a new member appointed to our Civic Events Committee, Francis Marcus. And then the Highway 89 corridor was signed by the council. The UDOT had said they're willing to sign it, so we've sent that back to them for their signature. As soon as we get their signature, then we're going to strike while the iron's hot and get the quitclaim deeds and get the greenway along Highway 89 transferred to North Salt Lake so that nobody ever comes along and says, let's tear down all these beautiful trees and widen Highway 89 right there. And then you have upcoming agenda items. Next week on the council, they will be working on your recommendation for the general development plan for Village Station and vacating that south portion of Orchard Drive. So we're really busy.
Did they get the geotechnical stuff back for that
area? Yeah, they're still working on the geotech. They have to have that done before they come back before you with the preliminary plat. And my brain was going to tell you one other thing. And as far as applications go, it's getting really busy. I just received the 6th application from Brighton. So they have 6 different projects. So we'll have a couple other agenda items on your next Planning Commission meeting, assuming that they get some red lines back to me. But a couple of them are just little minor things, but it's really heating up. So, and just to make you feel better, is only 13 working days until Mackenzie's back. Because I'm just counting it in working days, not in weeks.
I know we need our countdown that we had.
I have a countdown calendar, and every day I go in and put the X on another date. So
if she's watching, we miss her.
Yeah, we miss you.
She is watching. So
hope all is well.
There might be a little bit of delay, but anyway, we're getting busy, and so we're picking up in speed in building permits as well. So I think that we're going to see some things happen in the near future. So all of this happening and getting this. Urban design standards adopted is going to be very timely for us.
It's great.
And McDonald's may be here for real this time. So.
For real, McDonald's might be on the agenda next time.
It's the one on the corner of Redwood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
And then I have another application on Redwood Road for another fast food restaurant and maybe a coffee restaurant. But they haven't filed an official application, so it's not public information yet.
Nice.
But it, like I say, it's getting busy.
Nice. That's wonderful. Thank you. Okay, and then approval of the Planning Commission minutes from January 13th.
You were here.
Anybody have any adjustments to the minutes?
Commissioner Jorgensen, I was wanting to yield to Ryan, but he's shaking his head no. Always meeting minutes are an excellent job, so thank you for the great job on that. In this particular case, I think they were testing Ryan, but there are 4 typographical corrections. So anyway, I'll give those to Sherry, but I am prepared to offer a motion.
Thank you.
So I'll offer a motion to approve the Planning Commission meeting minutes as drafted for January 13, 2026, with 4 typographical corrections on line 112, 176, 187, and 275.
Thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen. Do we have a second?
Commissioner Holbrook, second.
Second, and all in favor. Say aye.
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 All right, and we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.